Hey, this is Dr. Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
And you are listening to radio station WBAI, 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org, everywhere. And the time is just about 7 p.m., which means it's time for another exciting edition of Off the Hook. Good evening to you. This program is Off the Hook. It is a show about fish. No, it is a show about what's going on in the world from the perspective of a bunch of people from the local hacker scene. And this is Rob T. Firefly here with you. And I am joined in the studio by Alex.
Good evening.
And by nobody else. We'll be bringing in some more of our regulars in a little bit to give us an update on their adventures. But for now, it's just the two of us on these mics, and there have been things going on today.
There absolutely have, and it, you know, just to comment on the two of us issue, it's whenever we're not here, I feel like they always complain about us not being here. So should we reciprocate that favor? I don't know if you have anything in particular you want to say about Emmanuel and Kyle while they're absent.
That's true. We haven't got them on the phone yet, so you know we could say anything right now.
They could be listening. Do you think they're listening?
Oh, they're probably listening.
They're always listening.
They hear everything, those guys. So yeah.
Big ears, mm-hmm. Both of them.
And I think we'll leave it at that for now. But now our esteemed colleagues will be joining us in just a few minutes while we work out some telephone connection plans. But yeah, so today there's a story that we have been following on this program since feels like time immemorial. Which is the net neutrality issue, and there was a vote today in the House of Representatives of this here country dealing with the issue. Now, Alex, you know a bit more about this than I do. So, how would you describe this?
I guess generally as another futile political gesture that will go absolutely nowhere.
Don't hold back. What do you really think?
Okay, sure. I guess we should summarize it before we go into it entirely, and then my analysis, my top-level analysis, will hopefully make a little bit more sense. You know, so there was another vote to repeal the Trump administration's repeal of the Obama-era rules that protected net neutrality, and then one of the first things that the Trump administration did with regard to the FCC was roll back some other Obama-era rules about monetizing information. This was a rule that was not yet even in effect, but it was an Obama-era rule that prevented ISPs from monetizing information on the subscribers. And then they proceeded swiftly to repealing net neutrality rules, which were the rules that prevented throttling or prioritizing certain types of traffic over others on the Internet, making what would essentially be the proverbial slow and fast lane. So everybody on both sides of the aisle, and by everybody I mean voters, has been opposed to the repeal of net neutrality, but yet Ajit Pai, the FCC chairman, pushed this forward and repealed the net neutrality rules that were in effect from the Obama era. And they did this through the Restore Internet Freedom Act, which was a complete misnomer because the only thing it's restoring is the ability for communications providers and ISPs to charge for a fast lane and a slow lane. And this has a lot of negative effects on our ability to, let's say, start a small company and compete with companies like Google and Facebook that would obviously, or Netflix that would be monopolizing the high speed lanes that would be created under net neutrality, and it would make it economically more difficult for these startups to compete with these larger voices, and it would drown out, therefore, the smaller guys and reduce our freedom of choice and expression on the internet. So there's all these big problems that we've been talking about quite literally for years in this program. And I have to say, I do get a little bit bored talking about net neutrality because it's always the same thing over and over and over again. And we're constantly repeating the mantra that, you know, around 85% of voters on both sides of the aisle support net neutrality. And so today in the House, which, of course, as we all know, is controlled by Democrats, there was a vote to repeal the net neutrality rules, and it passed. So that means it goes to the Senate. And this may pass the Senate, it may not. What's one thing that's interesting to note is that when in 2017, I believe it was, there was a Senate-led bill to repeal the repeal of net neutrality, meaning it would restore net neutrality, and it actually passed because there were some Republicans that crossed the aisle. I think there were three Republicans that crossed the aisle, and this passed, but at that time, the House was controlled by Republicans, not Democrats, and it stalled in the House. Now we have the opposite situation, where we have a bill originating in the House that's ultimately going to go to the Senate, which is now controlled by Republicans, and actually was controlled by Republicans back then, too. So even if they cross the aisle, it may be completely futile, because Senator Mitch McConnell has made it quite clear that he's going to use procedural rules to block this from ever coming up for a vote. That's a big problem. So even if there were enough votes for the Republicans, these three Republicans that would cross the line, the net neutrality rules would still never be voted on. And then let's say that this particular bill came up to the Senate for a vote. The Republicans crossed the line. We got it passed through the House. We got it passed through the Senate. This is all hypothetical. Then the president would veto it, and there still wouldn't be enough of a majority in the Senate to override the president's veto, which is why I said at the beginning of my rant that I feel like this is just a kind of another empty, boring political gesture of goodwill from politicians that is ultimately going to go absolutely nowhere, and demonstrates, I believe, just how powerful an administration is when it controls the executive branch and a single chamber of Congress. It makes the 2016 election, I think when we think about this, all the more important than the 2018 election, in which the Democrats regained only the House and not the Senate, seem all the more disappointing.
Okay, I was doing something else. Could you say all that again?
Yeah, let me start back from the top there.
Okay, actually, instead of that, I have our special guest on the phone. Emmanuel and Kyle, are you guys out there?
Yeah, well, I'd like to say something to that before we even get introduced. I feel very strongly what Alex just said and about everything that's been going on since 2017. It feels like everything is just for show and we never actually get any victories. And I just wonder, you know, what does it take for that to change?
It takes a new administration and Democrats controlling, again, a single chamber of Congress. That's what I think it's going to take. I mean, because we're
Alex,
so polarized.
Didn't we have a Democratic president and Democratic Congress before, and nothing seemed to change then either?
Well, we had rules in place that protected us. I mean, the Trump administration repealed those rules.
Rules? Okay, that's the thing that we keep playing by. Big mistake.
Yeah. Well, rules. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the rules have to change here. But it's, you know, look, we've got lawsuits from the state attorneys general that are being filed that are going to be heard very likely this summer. I don't know how much those are going to fly or whether they'll have legs, whatever analogy you want to use, because of this concept of Chevron deference that's given to agencies in their particular decisions. But what's interesting here, though, Emmanuel, is that the Republicans also have their own proposal on the table now to repeal the repeal of net neutrality and restore net neutrality. But it's a proposal that doesn't give the FCC any ability to actually enforce these particular rules. So it would be a mandate without any teeth. And the Republicans see this as giving the FCC, a regulatory body, more authority. And any issue of regulation, anything that would broad any regulatory body's authority, is for Republicans by default just a bad thing, regardless of whether that broader mandate would do things like protect consumers, maybe enhance First Amendment rights, our rights to publish, protect our freedom of association, and is generally supported by over 85% of the electorate. So I think until Republicans start seeing regulation as not something inherently bad, we're going to have this polarization over this fight.
Alex, I'd like to agree with that, but I think it's until the American people start realizing that they're being lied to and misled. I mean, just what's going on with the FAA alone over the past few weeks with that whole 737 thing, not grounding them when they should have, instead just deferring to Boeing, that should tell you right there that deregulation and stripping of power of federal regulatory agencies is a bad idea. And I'm saying this as a subject of the FCC, you know, an agency that's caused me tremendous grief over the years, all of us. You do need regulations. You do need teeth behind these rules. And when you take that away, people die and all kinds of horrible things happen. Anyway, let's introduce ourselves. It's Emmanuel, Carl over here.
Hello.
And our friend Greg Newby.
Hey, good to be here.
And we're all in Ontario right now having a smart car adventure because, well, it was time. We hadn't done that in a while. And the smart car wanted to go back home for a bit and, visit some of its friends in Canada. So here we are.
Well, hey, and how are you, Greg and Kyle and Emmanuel? Welcome back to the show. And how was the trip up to Ontario? Did you drive the smart car there?
Well, we had a small adventure. I think the best way to put it is that the smart car needed Greg's help, and he was there to help us transport it. And other than a nice long drive, it was very smooth.
Let's just say we drove it to where a trailer was waiting, that we could drive it up onto the trailer. And here's a fun fact. You know that smart car wheels are narrower than the tread on trailers that you drive up on.
No, I didn't, but I guess...
We do now. We know that. We know that it's really, you know, the tires hang off by about a little over 50% on each side. So it's very invigorating to do that.
Oh, so the thing that you drive up, the ramp, is narrower than the wheels?
Yeah, they kind of stick, hang over.
It's wider than the wheels, so that the wheels almost fall off on the inside.
Yeah. So, definitely... I was helping drive the thing onto this contraption, and it really did. It was great. It got my my heart racing a bit and increased my blood pressure, and it made me really feel alive.
And I found religion, so now I've got to have to fill some obligations.
And the angle at which you're driving this thing up into a tractor trailer is pretty steep, right? I mean, it's not exactly 45, but it's got to be like 30 degrees or 35 or something at least, right? So,
so
if you go off the edge, it's nerve-wracking.
Especially in a car that's like 4 feet long with a flat back, you do kind of feel like it's going to tip over backwards on itself. But suffice to say, the vehicle's been transported, and it's in good hands, and it'll be getting a nice, well-deserved tune-up.
And our smart car is different than the ones you see on the road in the States. They never introduced this one in the States. It's purely a Canadian car. It's diesel. It's a little bit smaller. So people still are amazed when they see it because nothing quite like it has ever come into the States.
And this actually ties in a lot, just the maintenance and, you know, getting the right kind of parts for older vehicles and stuff like that. It ties in a lot with right to repair and, you know, the ability to access vehicle computer systems, to have tools, to have schematics and so on. So in the end, it ended up, it was that we needed to get it to the right kind of place that can handle those things and do the necessary maintenance, as opposed to us continuing DIY solutions. So that's basically all there is to say about that.
Well, and speaking of right to repair, did you see the editorial in the New York Times this week supporting the right to repair?
Oh yes, it was a good read, and it's one of those issues that we've been talking about for about 100 years. But like, it's interesting to see the mainstream come around and start recognizing it as a concern.
Yeah, and build it into platforms.
that's an area where Canada is actually ahead of the curve. They're, I don't know how soon legislation will occur, but Canada is already working on right to repair legislation at the national level.
Canada is ahead of the United States in many areas, we found out.
Like what? What other areas could they possibly be ahead of this great country, the United States of America?
Well, cannabis legalization is another one. It's legal all throughout the entire country here.
Yeah, in fact, the stores, so we're in Ontario, and the stores were a little late. The legalization occurred about a year ago, and then Ontario began with their online, you know, web-based purchases this year in 2019, and the stores just opened, I think it was April 1st.
Yeah,
so there's some number, it's a pretty small number, I think under 20 stores around Ontario, where you go in, you have to show you're 19, even to get into the store, so you can't bring a kid to, you know, look at the pretty flowers and stuff. And then you can get your, you know, your variety of products.
And there's one one thing I noticed just reading up on some of the rules, because as Greg indicated, it was a slower kind of methodic rollout, starting with the online sales in Ontario. But the retail locations and other laws, they paced themselves, I think, really well, and I think it's something that some of the states considering it and the nation, national efforts in the U.S. could definitely model and learn from. Was that, you know, they're open to letting people consume cannabis in public. Yeah, like in a park and on sidewalks. It's okay here.
And meanwhile, in states like New York and New Jersey, cannabis legalization has been put on hold by Democrats, if you can believe that, and through all kinds of ignorant misinformation, such as it's going to make things more dangerous for kids. It actually makes things safer for kids, because once you have legalization and you have to buy marijuana in a approved location, approved store, they check to make sure kids aren't buying it. Dealers on corners don't do that. And it's also, it's not, I don't want to get into a whole big thing because it's really not our usual subject matter, but it's not a gateway drug because it does not lead to other drugs except by somebody suggesting, hey, maybe you should try this other drug, which is something a dealer will do. Somebody in the store is not going to do that.
Yeah, it's about safe access.
Yeah, so these people saying that it's dangerous, we're not ready for it yet, they really annoy me because they're speaking out of ignorance, they're speaking out of things in the past that have been proven to be wrong, and other states have legalized it, Canada has legalized it, the benefits are immense, health-wise, you know, for medical marijuana alone, but the recreational benefits as well are something to be modeled after.
Can I ask you a quick question? Of you guys about the legalization of marijuana in Canada, did the legalization of marijuana in Canada help or hinder your ability to drive the truck, drive the car into the truck?
It added a couple of mandatory questions at the border, but otherwise it was non-impactful.
Yeah, and it didn't apply. First of all, we were in New York when we did it.
Gotcha.
You know, it could have only helped, I think, but no, we not all kidding aside. No, that's not we take this seriously.
Yeah, they're very strict about the border crossings, because even though you can fly with up to 30 grams within Canada, and you might
Hold on. You can fly with pot?
Up to 30 grams.
Wow.
It's just how much individuals can possess.
Yeah, but you can't fly from Washington to Colorado with pot. They won't
exactly
do that.
And nor can you fly from, say, Toronto to Denver because you're crossing border.
Okay, but can you fly from Washington to Oregon? They border each other, and it's legal in both states. Can you do that? Can someone help us with this?
I don't think that you can, because you're going to be subject to other federal regulations. Yeah, and TSA inspection, which is a federal agency, which is going to be subject to different DOJ regulations than the states are subject to. So I would probably say no. I wouldn't advise any of my clients to try that.
Alex, you're asking us how Canada is ahead, and you're giving us more examples. This is another way Canada is ahead of us.
I completely agree in some respects that they certainly are, and I don't see the federal policy with respect to marijuana legalization changing anytime soon, which is why, again, you have these really idiotic systems in place in places like Colorado where they don't necessarily have access to the banking system because of FDIC regulations and federal regulations regarding the transfer of money. So you have marijuana and cannabis businesses essentially doing business in what is just cash, you know, and which raises a whole host of separate security issues with respect to those particular businesses in these states. So, yeah, I tend to agree, even though I raise the question that in some respects Canada can be ahead of us. But I have to say, so did you guys drive up through Vermont to get there?
We drove up through New York, but
okay.
We're not going to get too specific, are we? Are we going to tell exactly what roads we took?
Well, I think it's interesting to comment that we crossed at the Thousand Islands.
That's pretty specific.
Yeah,
okay,
pretty
yeah,
specific.
Okay,
but,
yeah, but, we did
but,
that.
And it was interesting because the Thousand Islands is brand. They've rebuilt it for Canada Day, the 150th celebration of Canada's becoming a country last year. So yeah, we didn't have to go through Vermont.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks brand new, and I think they're even working on a wall to keep Americans out.
You know, I used to live in Montpelier in Vermont, and I would drive up, not regularly, but fairly often, to Montreal. And it always struck me that when you're driving up through Vermont, you know, it's beautiful, there's mountains everywhere, it sort of looks like a fairy tale when you're driving out, even on the interstate. And then you get to the border, you go through the border. I was never really hassled going into Montreal. But then as soon as you would cross the border, the landscape became so incredibly dull. It was just flat and nothing around until you got to Montreal. And I just thought that, you know, it might have been sort of commentary on what we thought of Canadians. That, you know, it's just there's flat, boring land, but apparently it's not. Apparently it's the land of milk and honey over there.
Well, I wouldn't say that's a reflection of the people. The people in Canada are overall really a kind, welcoming bunch. And I actually noticed the same thing driving around, that just how quickly you can get rural and into these sort of agrarian and wooded and natural landscapes. It's truly beautiful, and it's amazing how much of Canada is undeveloped and really wild, and it is truly, truly beautiful to experience.
Now, can I say something else that Canada is better at than we are?
Please.
And that's television. We were basically trying to watch an over-the-air television program last night. We didn't have television, so we had to go online. Now, in the States, you know, you have to jump through all kinds of hoops and show your proof of residence and sit through all kinds of advertisements and things like that. They have CBC has a streaming service called Gem up here. And you simply have to sign up for it. It doesn't cost anything. And boom, instantly you have access to up to, I think, 15 CBC channels from around the country. You can see local news from different places, something that apparently is illegal in the States. And you can just basically benefit. And guess what? When a commercial comes on, they just stop. It just says, we'll be back soon. You don't see anything. Imagine that in the States.
Yeah, they limit the advertisers because they're not paying for your market. They're paying for cable and other subscription services. So they don't, by default, just throw that into any old platform. They very deliberately direct those ads.
Now, I presume that you would need a Canadian IP address in order to access that GEM service?
Well, that's interesting because we tried to access it through an Apple device that was registered in the United States, and it didn't work. And when we used something that was basically tied to Canada, it did work. So, there are ways around that, of course. You can use all kinds of VPN solutions to basically show up anywhere in the world you want to. But once you do that, it's relatively easy.
You know, I was in London last week, and, you know, the BBC obviously has something very similar to BBC iPlayer, which you, if you want to get the iPlayer app for your iPhone, you have to have a device that's registered with an Apple account that's tied to a UK bank account, so it becomes very difficult to do that, and then they geo-block you by your IP address. But when I was in London last week, I could access the BBC iPlayer through the web and through the app with my regular U.S. iPhone. Everything worked swimmingly. It was, a real pleasure to use that. And, again, you know, there are ways around it by using a VPN that pops you out in the U.K., but most of these services I've realized have already taken account of the various IP addresses that belong to these particular services. One way around that blocking, though, I've found is that if you get a specialized, dedicated IP address for yourself that maybe you and a few other people use, which is, you know, only another dollar or two per month, that's one way to access perhaps the BBC iPlayer when you're outside of the UK. And I wonder if that would work with the Canadian GEM service as well.
So we don't know for sure about where CBC will let you play back. And we actually played back through a regular web browser on a Canadian IP address. But the experience we had was almost the opposite, or it's a similar situation to yours, but the opposite implementation, which was we tried to download the app. So they have this app called GEM, G-E-M, and it said you're not in the right region to download. Now, we're in Canada, right? I tried it on my Canadian phone, you know, my Canadian phone number. I tried it on my Canadian IP address, and I tried it on my, iPad that was on the same IP address. So why wouldn't it let me download? Because I have a Apple ID, which is associated with my American credit card number and my in-laws' address back there. And so it didn't care where you were. It cared where your billing was. And how does it decide where your billing is, what country? It decides because it forces you to give a credit card with an associated valid mail address. So that was interesting. In other words, they didn't care where you were. They did care about where you were sort of homed from their account. And I actually had the experience when we moved to Canada, which is why I still keep this account associated in the U.S., because I bought some movies and, you know, some apps and a couple of other things through the Apple Store. And when I moved to Canada, I said, okay, I'll change to my Canadian credit card number and, you know, just continue on in Canada. And I did that, no big deal. You can do that in the Apple, store, in the Apple portal. But suddenly all my content went away. Even stuff that I could buy in Canada, right? So I got in touch with Apple. They were pretty helpful. And they said, dude, you know, your content is licensed for basically where your billing address is.
This is stuff you already had bought and was on your device.
I didn't fool myself. It doesn't mean that I own anything, right? I have a limited time license under the 30-page Apple terms of service.
It doesn't mean you own something in their world. In your world, I think you do own it.
Yes, I always wonder about this because I don't know, say I get Apocalypse Now. I have Apocalypse Now on VHS. I have Apocalypse Now on DVD. I have the director cut on Blu-ray, right? And so I buy it in the Apple Store. Which one can go away?
You're going to have Apocalypse then because it's going to disappear. Alex, another way that Canada is better, I don't mean to make a whole list, but you got me going here. They still have snow, lots of it. In fact, they got lots of snow this year, and it's awesome.
Well, there's still lots of snow in the United States as well. I mean, they don't have exclusivity on snow at the moment, by the way. I was in the Poconos 2 weeks ago. We had huge amounts of snow. I couldn't even back the car out of the driveway. So I don't buy that as a reason for Canada being so great.
I've seen you try to back the car out of the driveway. The snow has got nothing to do with it.
This time it was turned on.
Okay, one more thing, just off the top of my head. They have phone booths here, lots of them. You know, we go from town to town. And we always see a big Bell payphone booth, not just a payphone, but a booth, you know. And we got rid of the booths first, and then we got rid of the payphones. They're doing exactly what we talk about week after week. They have the old technology just sitting there in case you need it. It's easily available. You can see it from a distance. And it's really comforting to know that the payphone is always there, and they work.
That's amazing. You should take them. I'm sorry. You should take some photos of the phone booths while you're there.
The booths, I think, are partially there because of the wind, you know, because it's cold in Canada. But the telecom situation is not that bright in Canada. Canada has, you know, we're in a somewhat rural area, not totally rural, but we're in an area where, you know, we don't have any broadcast over the air TV. We don't have any cable TV options. And the DSL, which we do have, luckily, because we have a landline, is only about a megabit down. So that's behind. And a lot of the communities in Canada are much more rural than we are, including a vast what they call First Nations. So Native American is what you would call them in the U.S. And they are indigenous populations, and they are grossly underserved by the modern telecom. So I think the phone booths are good in themselves, but I think they're also offsetting the relative lack of, you know, the Internet and the wireless infrastructure.
See, we don't have that problem with indigenous people. We just pretend they don't exist, and we move on.
Well, let me push back on the phone booth issue again as well. I mean, here in New York, we've gotten rid of all the phone booths, and you know, before we got rid of all those phone booths, people were just, you know, making anonymous phone calls, committing crimes using those public pay phones. They were disgusting. Don't you feel safer under the watchful eye, the watchful three eyes, I should mention, of Link NYC kiosks, having replaced all of those pay phones where you can go and make a free call, charge your device, maybe even watch some pornography on the street while you're there?
I mostly appreciate the way it's really cut down on crime.
Yes, you know, exactly. I was all sarcastic, by the way.
You know, the thing, Alex, is that Link NYC is only in NYC. There's all kinds of communities up here. They all have phone, I assume they all have phone booths. And in the States, you know, there's different phone companies, there's different towns, and they're pretty much being taken out of all of them. And it's not just in the United States. It's in many places. It's a big mistake. It's, you know, we love technology, we love advances, but hang on to the old stuff as well, because they can complement each other.
I completely agree. And speaking of the Commonwealth, when I was in London last week, I did notice that they are installing the equivalent of Link NYC kiosks all throughout London, and they're called InLink UK, and they also have the BT logo on them. It seems like a lot of them are not in use yet, but I took some photos. We can share some online if anybody cares. But
they're learning from what's gone on in New York. I wonder if, as the show talked about Huawei before, because the differentiation of Huawei's in the news, right? The woman that was apprehended and so forth. But Huawei is very big in Canada. They're in supercomputing, but more importantly, they are the primary carrier infrastructure. So they basically replaced Northern Telecom with the switches for cellular and landline, and to some extent, a lesser extent, but to some extent, with the internet.
Well, that's not the Chinese woman who was detained that I want to talk about. There is another one who was detained in Florida. Alex, I think you've got some details on this.
Yes. I mean, I think this has been all over the news. There was this Chinese woman that was somehow tangentially connected with the woman that ran the massage parlor in which Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, was found to have been soliciting prostitution and various acts. And she showed up at Mar-a-Lago, made her way past Secret Service agents by first telling them that she was there, I believe, for some kind of pool party, and then the United Nations International Friends event, which didn't exist. And she was found with all manner of devices on her, I think 9 USB devices, some cash, a separate device that was able to detect hidden security cameras. And she intended on making her way over to President Trump. And it was only through the valiant efforts of the receptionist, not the Secret Service, who recognized that she was not in a place where she should have been allowed and had called security, at which point she was apprehended, arrested, and remains in federal custody until at least Monday, when there is a bond hearing, at which I'm sure all the major media are going to be in attendance, and we'll get some further details about her statements, which appear to be changing by the moment, about her reasons for being there, her whereabouts, her connections to China. And this whole story is to me so incredibly bizarre and frankly unbelievable. And obviously now there is this FBI counterintelligence investigation into her activities as well.
Well, I just want to ask you, legally, what is it that they're holding her for? What is her crime? She went to a resort, a second-class resort, and didn't belong there. That's something that I think we've all done many, many times. What is it exactly that is the crime?
Yeah, she had malware. So, I mean, how many individuals at Mar-a-Lago have malware? The president probably has malware.
But how do you find out somebody has malware? I mean, do you ask them? What was the chain of events here?
Well, to answer the first question about the particular crimes, I haven't actually seen the criminal complaint, but she did plead not guilty to whatever it was she was charged with, but I would imagine it was some kind of inchoate offense or attempt at infiltrating this for foreign intelligence purposes, that she's basically being held on suspicion of being an agent of a foreign power. Now, interestingly enough, if she was an agent of a foreign power and she was traveling under official cover of that particular government, you wouldn't be able to hold her because she would have had diplomatic immunity. So if she was an agent of a foreign power, namely China, which is what everybody is suspecting, she would have been traveling under non-official cover, which means that if she gets caught, and she did get caught, that there was really nothing that the Chinese government could do in trying to extricate her from this particular legal mess that she now finds herself in.
Yeah, but Alex, she didn't infiltrate the White House. She went to a country club. How is it that a Chinese national is not allowed to go to a country club?
Well, she was trespassing to begin with, and she obviously had the intention to do something that was about the collection of intelligence with respect to the President of the United States. So, I mean, I think it's reasonable that she was picked up and held here on these federal charges. Plus, if you add to that the fact that she had these nine USB devices, several passports in her name, which I didn't mention originally, it indicates some kind of intent to, let's say, violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, infiltrate a network, commit these particular crimes, and collect intelligence with regard to the President of the United States. All of this is really, really bad. However, I do have to say, though, that if this was a foreign intelligence operation, it was so bumbling and idiotic that it just defies my imagination that this really could have been a state-sponsored act trying to infiltrate Mar-a-Lago with the purpose of collecting foreign intelligence. I think it's more likely to me and more reasonable that this woman is being used as a cutout by somebody to try to make a point, perhaps, about the lax security at Mar-a-Lago.
And that
Alex,
raises an interesting
the thing that was surprising to me was it essentially criminalized having four phones, being infected with malware, and having like two passports and not having a bathing suit and also not knowing quite the right name of the conference, because the name that she had was pretty close to the conference that was happening, I think, the day before or the day after. Uh-huh. So that was what was remarkable to me and got me thinking that this was, as you're saying, you know, sort of a there's something else that's going on or maybe not going on behind the story.
And there are a couple of things that really bug me about this. Number one, the fact that you can go to a country club to get intelligence about the U.S. president tells me that there probably isn't very much intelligence there to begin with, but it really that is the violation as far as I'm concerned, that this kind of thing is happening where you have a place like this that's not a government facility, it's just basically someone's pad. That is where all the secret discussions are taking place. That's something that we need to study. But the other thing it has to do with the malware itself. Now, she had thumb drives, and apparently some bozo of a Secret Service agent decided he was going to plug one into his own computer system, and guess what? It did all kinds of things to his system, which, you know what? The thumb drives I carry, if somebody plugs them into their system, the same thing's going to happen. That's called defense.
Well, and defense is important, too, because this whole Mar-a-Lago situation, as you mentioned, this is not a government facility, and we have places that it's traditionally thought of as the places the president will do their work, the White House, Camp David even, places where there's the infrastructure for the government to provide the proper security and everything else. But because we have a president who's decided that he'd rather hang out at a country club that he owns so taxpayer dollars can go to his own business for his stay there, like they then had to just rig up whatever security they could, you know, whatever protection they could at this place that was not intended to house such dignitaries, and we're seeing things like this as a result. Someone just breaking into a country club, or you know, sneaking into a country club, is now doing things that get the Secret Service dogpiling on you like this.
Well, and to be fair, and I think there's been a lot of chatter about this, the wisdom of plugging this particular USB device into a Secret Service computer, and the Secret Service had made a statement about this to Verge, basically saying, I'll quote it, I'll read it, but stop me if you get bored. Quote, assertions that U.S. Secret Service agents are incompetent to carry out forensic examinations on digital media, that is, thumb drives, laptops, cell phones, etc., is outlandish and not rooted in fact. The Secret Service Electronic Crime Special Agent Program, known as XSAP, is internationally recognized, and special agents across the agency receive extensive training in computer forensics and undergo a rigorous certification process. Forensic examinations conducted by these personnel are done in accordance with U.S. Secret Service standard operating procedures. Secret Service forensic examinations are conducted on standalone computers equipped with specialized forensic software, probably NCASE, which are not connected to Secret Service networks. So they seem to really be backtracking this, but it that statement doesn't necessarily jive with what I think was in the sworn statement of the particular Secret Service agent.
Well, so it was released, right? I mean, so if all this stuff is true that you just read, you didn't mention anything about having this be part of the top news story worldwide. as the investigation is going on before the woman even appears in court. So there's something, like I said, I think there's something less or something more than is being told there.
Well, I
don't
agree.
Doubt the ability of Secret Service to do forensic investigations or get their buddies over at another agency to do it, but how often do you see them talked about publicly?
Well, let's parse this out, because I think there is something completely askew about this whole situation, and let's think about the malware for a second, too, right? I mean, what the Secret Service agent had said on the record in the sworn statement was that this started immediately, this malware, once it was plugged in via USB device, started copying files immediately, right? I mean, if this had been an intelligence operation, I don't think that the malware would have just started wildly copying files from or onto the particular system on which it was mounted as a device. Compromising the President of the United States would have probably involved malware that was a little bit more narrowly tailored, carefully crafted, and stealthy. And then think about this pool issue, and then the event that you mentioned as well, Greg, that she said she was going to the United Nations International Friendship event, and before that she said she was going to the pool. All of this is kind of bumbling. If this, again, was a foreign intelligence operation, they wouldn't have had to guess at the particular event or name. What the intelligence agency would have done was actually organize an event at Mar-a-Lago through some kind of proprietary company or organization that they have within the United States, and then all of their people would have lawful access to the particular building. It's probably, and frankly, not that very hard to do at Mar-a-Lago if you pay a lot of money to that organization to organize an event like the United Nations or International Friendship event. Sounds like
a
great deal.
They're open for business, right?
They are open for business.
I was really interested in, Alex, I wonder if you saw anything additional about this, was the device or whatever it was for spotting hidden cameras. Well, I wonder what that was. I can think of it in terms of a listener, like listening for signals in the 5 gigahertz spectrum, something like that. But what would this even be that someone would be carrying around with them?
And where can we buy one? Because we need that.
I guess that was why I was asking.
You know, I don't know. I've been trying to find a bit of information about that particular device myself. But to go to the devices issue as well, again, another completely unbelievable fact from this story is that this woman who's trying to infiltrate Mar-a-Lago is carrying this huge amount of USB devices and this whatever device it is to detect hidden cameras on her, you know, just out in the open in a bag or someplace that's easily detectable. That would be horrible tradecraft for a foreign intelligence operative to just have these things out and exposed. I mean, it seems like it was designed to have been detected. This issue of cash as well, that, as you also mentioned, Greg, there was an investigation carried out and a search warrant issued for her hotel room, it seems like, before she had ever appeared in court because of the urgency and exigency of the situation. And there was all this cash found in her hotel room. And this Zhang's woman's explanation for this was, with respect to the cell phones that she had on her and the USB devices, was that she felt that they weren't going to be safe in her hotel room. But, you know, apparently $8,000 in cash was okay to leave in the hotel room, so it doesn't necessarily jive. But, again, this says to me, no way, doesn't pass a smell test for a foreign intelligence operation. Why would they be using cash in such a small amount? The cash in the hotel room indicates to me that somebody local might have paid her to do this and act as some kind of cutout to make a point.
Giving her all of these tools and gizmos as props to embolden the behavior.
Exactly.
And also get caught. In response to what Greg had mentioned, I wondered the exact same thing, what kind of specific technology. I know we'll probably not get a lot of answers. And the only couple things I could think of just in my pure imaginative mind would be reflections and things from lenses, like in an optical sense. But I think that's less likely. I think really what you're talking about with video countermeasures would be a device that is sensitive enough to pick up the noise from the components that are commonly used. In other words, a common component that every CCD requires when it's encoding optical data into a digital format, is something so sensitive that you could run across a wall and be close enough in proximity to pick up that noise basically visual information being encoded into binary and so forth.
Can I just mention one more thing? And I want to hear from Rob because I haven't heard from him in a while. Basically, according to the New York Times, the way this crazy event transpired, this is what's interesting. She arrived for this quote-unquote United Nations friendship event. She showed the agent an invitation to that event, but it was in Chinese. Nobody there could read Chinese. So that's why she was escorted off the property. Nobody could read the invitation. The agent questioned her after escorting her off the property, and then she became verbally aggressive, and that's when she was detained, when she became verbally aggressive. She basically got a Secret Service agent angry, and from that point on, she was held in custody. But if she hadn't gotten verbally aggressive, probably none of this would have happened.
Interesting, which would support the theory that she was there to prove a point and get into the news with all this.
Yeah, I like the $8,000 connection or whatever it was. That makes it sound like whatever it was not a government action because of the way it was bungled. The thing that Kyle was talking about, my other thought on this, I think that's a good one, some sort of signal detection, listening device. The other thing that was thought I had was infrared. So if you're in an area that has cameras that are going to see in the dark, they probably have infrared emitters.
Absolutely.
And those you can pick up even on an iPhone.
Definitely. So, that would be something like night vision would see very obviously if a small infrared diode was on the camera board itself. But, we're probably not going to see much in the way of details, but perhaps we will. The plot thickens, as they say.
And to build off Rob's, I think, very valid point that, this does definitely seems like it was designed to have gotten her caught. On the other hand, one other theory with respect to her verbal aggression that you brought up, Emmanuel, is that perhaps she was being paid in milestones. $8,000 was for her to do this. Initially, that might have been half or a third of the particular payment. If she got in there, if she was able to do something else or take pictures or demonstrate that she was able to get into the inner sanctum or the sanctum sanctorum, so to speak, of Mar-a-Lago, she might have gotten more money for that, and that could have caused her to become more verbally aggressive because maybe there was a $50,000 or $100,000 payout waiting for her had she gotten out and taken pictures or something like that. But one other thing I want to bring up, too, which is a bit of a mystery to me and I think to everybody who's following this particular story, is I don't understand why there hasn't been more about this woman's background and history in China coming out yet from the media. She's a real person. She has a history. She has a real name. It's difficult to conduct investigations in China because of the names and the translation issues and transliteration issues of names in Chinese and whatnot, but the media is really good at this kind of thing, and investigators are really, really good at this kind of thing. The woman has said I believe it was FBI, that she was involved in finance in China, that she owns a $1 million home in China, and none of this seems to make sense with the idea that she would be paid $8,000 to go on this insane escapade into Mar-a-Lago with all these devices. So I really want more information from the media, from the investigators, to come out about what the hell she was up to in China before this, because there's got to be history there. And it's weird to me that nothing has come out about that yet.
That's a very good point.
It is weird. I guess the other thing I'm wondering about is follow the money, which usually the media are good at. So if there's $8,000 for a fairly poor penetration test, who might want to pay that type of money as opposed to millions with a well-equipped, excursion and would equip with this sort of way? And that to me, that brings all kinds of things to mind, definitely including the regular media. Because if you were any company, anyone doing looking for dirt on the administration, you might say, well, how easy is it to break into Mar-a-Lago?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, this really smells or sort of reeks really of the issues that plagued the UK quite a few years ago with the blagging efforts of private detectives using all these illicit means to access phones and personal data and doing all kinds of skullduggerous activities that they shouldn't have been doing, and perhaps it is something like that. What's also interesting is that, to my knowledge, and I don't follow the president on Twitter out of principle, but I haven't seen Trump tweeting anything about this, or I haven't heard about him tweeting anything about this, blaming it on the Democrats or blaming it on the media yet, which is something that you would necessarily have expected from him.
True. Well, it's a story we're going to be following, and I'm sure it's going to develop in all sorts of interesting ways.
Well, let me ask you guys a quick question on this. You know, so we've got a bail hearing on Monday. Do you think that that she's going to make bail?
Well, I know I'd like to know how the media covers it. I think that would be a very interesting thing to study. It depends. Who's got the $8,000 in cash?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the issue would be, is she going to be granted bail at all? That could set bail at $5 million. She would have to pay a portion of that. Or she could be considered a flight risk, at which point, you know, the federal judge that would be addressing this case would say, absolutely not, you're going to stay in jail until this case is heard, just like Maria Butina.
That'll be a factor, but also I think they might not know what they want to know to bring the rest of the case. In other words, they might want more time to gather evidence, to trace back, whether it's the money or the devices or the, you know, the passports or things like that.
Personally, I think it's a witch hunt, an illegal investigation, and I don't think they're going to find any collusion. What do I know?
Yeah. News.
Well, you know, Greg brought up a really, really great point, and if, you know, she's being represented right now by a federal defender, as I understand it, a legal aid attorney. She doesn't have a private practice attorney representing her, unless somebody's going to make an appearance for her on Monday, and that would also be rather interesting. But, Greg, you make some really good points that, you know, as it stands right now, she was essentially trespassing and just holding on to some interesting devices, and she was infected by malware. If I were the defense attorney trying to argue for her bail or the dismissal of these particular charges, those would be the arguments that I would make.
All right. Hey, there's one more story I'd like to get to if we have time, and that's that message that was sent to Amazon. You guys hear about this?
No, which message?
It's from the rainforest. They want their name back.
Yes.
The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, known as ICANN, recently decided to expand its list of generic top-level domains, known as GTLDs, and they have .amazon. But 8 countries containing the Amazon rainforest objected to the retail giant's plans concerning the new .amazon domain name. Governments are Bolivia, Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, Guyana, Peru, Suriname, and, wait for it, Venezuela. All members of the Amazon Cooperation Treaty Organization, known as ACTO, they say that relinquishing the domain exclusively to Amazon could impact on matters of their sovereignty. And, you know, in this era where, you know, domains are decided by geography, amongst many other things, it seems like geography would trump a corporation. Not to coin a phrase, but what do you think, Alex?
Well, this is an issue that I've actually worked on for about 7 years now. More like eight. I was instrumental in the new GTLD application process by which you applied for these strings that would be delegated as top-level domains, and top-level meaning to the right of the dot in an Internet address. So you have gmail.com. .com is a top-level domain. Gmail is a second-level domain, or the domain name itself. And this was a process that kicked off really in 2011 with the creation of the applicant guidebook for the new GTLD application program, and then the application period was opened in 2012, at which point I was part of a team of attorneys between New York and D.C. We represented Google or Yahoo. I worked personally, by the way, on over 200 applications. And this is a battle that has literally been brewing between Amazon and these particular states since 2012 when they put in their application for .amazon. It's been going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And there's a specialized committee in ICANN known as the GAC, or the Governmental Advisory Committee, which has representatives from all different countries that participate in ICANN that provide advice to the ICANN board, and it's very, very difficult to get a new GTLD application passed if you don't have GAC consensus advice, which this Amazon application has been struggling with for the exact reasons that you had mentioned to us, Emmanuel. And what's kind of bizarre to me, though, is that this was something that started 7 years ago with the kickoff of the new GTLD program. Since that particular period of time, a lot of .brand TLDs, meaning, you know, brand names like, you know, Nationwide or Pepsi, Cola, you know, Coke, things like that. So you have Dot Coke, Dot Pepsi, et cetera, have been delegated. They've gone live. They've gone into the root zone of the Internet. Domain names could resolve. But all of these particular brands have really been struggling with how to use them, how to monetize them, how to market them, and a huge amount of them have been abandoned. They've gone inactive, and they have decided that, you know what, it's no longer worth me to pay the $25,000 fee per year to ICANN for this top-level domain that nobody's using, that nobody understands, that nobody's going to navigate to. But yet Amazon continues to persist in this particular battle despite the fierce opposition from these particular countries and the GAC. So it raises the question to me about what they have up their sleeve with this particular Don Amazon. And they offered some concessions to these countries as well, giving them the two-letter country code as a top-level domain, like EC.Amazon would be for Ecuador, and they wouldn't
do it. Alex, they're offering concessions to the eight countries in the Amazon region. Think about that. Think how wrong that is, that a corporation is offering them concessions. They should be the ones in control offering Amazon.
Well, they are. They are, and I don't think this will get passed unless they get past the GAC issue as well. But the other thing, too, to think about is that this was Amazon 7 years ago when they put in this application. Amazon 7 years ago is a completely different animal from the Amazon that we see now. And I wonder how their plans have changed for this .Amazon TLD. I think that they have got very significant and concrete plans. Otherwise, they wouldn't be spending the amount of time, resources, and certainly capital on legal bills to try to push this thing forward with ICANN. So this is definitely a battle worth watching.
And, of course, there's precedent for this sort of thing in the sphere of ICANN. There was the 2004 case where a computer repair person called Uzi Nissan had registered Nissan.com in the early days of the Internet. And Nissan, the motor company, when they decided they wanted a website on this here Internet, they tried to sue him for it and lost because he's entitled to use his own name, and he was there first. In this case, I think the Amazon, as in the geographical location, was in fact there first before the company that throws cardboard boxes all over the place.
That's true. And there was another specialized application procedure during this process, and Dot Africa is an example of that. So Dot Africa was delegated and put into the root zone, and that was known as a community application, which meant that in order for it to go through as a community application and be processed, they had to demonstrate that they had consensus from a community of African nations that supported them being in control of this particular top-level domain, which they did, and it got passed through. Amazon did not have that. So they are really butting heads with these particular sovereign nations, and ICANN is going to be under a very strong microscope here because the international community has always suspected that ICANN, because it's a not-for-profit corporation registered in California, of all places, could be susceptible to U.S. interests. God forbid, right? So I think that Amazon has that going against them as well, that ICANN needs to be seen as much more international, much more sensitive to underserved communities and countries where local content could necessarily be compromised by the delegation of these top-level domains.
You know, it just bothers me that we're talking about a .Amazon top-level domain and 2600 can't even get an Instagram account.
That's true. I know. Yeah, well, life isn't fair, I guess.
Nope. Except in Canada, where it's
yeah,
awesome.
That's right. Exactly. But I think we should definitely watch this. I'm sure we'll continue to report on this as this battle rages on.
We're going to have to kind of leave it there because we are just about out of time. But I'm sorry, guys. You guys enjoy the rest of your trip to Canada, and we look forward to hearing all about how your adventures went in the days in the week to come.
We will. Thanks for having us, and we enjoyed the chat.
Totally. Thank you, Greg Newby, for joining us again. Kyle, watch your hand. Be careful with that. And have a great week. So, email us, oth@2600.com. Find us on Twitter at Hacker Radio Show. Find us on Mastodon, Hacker Radio Show at mastodon.social if you're living that life, as we are. For Off the Hook, this is Rob T. Firefly. Have a very good night.